5 is not a magic number. It seems to come in really rather late in the tradition. In Genesis 19 and 18 and 19, there are only two cities which undergo the destruction, Sodom and Gomorrah. And many literary critics feel that the original tradition may have only been one city that became related to others as the ruins were seen or related to one another by the occupants who built up the tradition, by the later people who built up the tradition. When we look at this map, which is a reconstruction of the area of Canaan before the Israelites came in the Iron Age, done by Aharoni. This dotted line, as he reconstructs from the biblical text, comes around the southeastern edge of the Dead Sea, includes Zoar. All the rest of this area would be in Moab, but this is belonging to the land of Canaan. In the above this area, or below this area, we have occupation during the Iron Age, both Baphic and at Safi at Zoar, and at Khanazir, there is some Iron Age material. Above that line, the two sites of Baba Dra and Mira, there is no occupation from the end of the early Bronze Age down to the Roman Byzantine time. Yet the ruins as they are today must have been very evident to the people there. So that in conclusion, I would say, keeping in mind all of the qualifications I think I have tried to make about the biblical text itself and about the formation of the traditions, that if one is looking for possible candidates for these cities of the plains, the only ones we have here at the southeastern edge of the Dead Sea are the sites of Baba Dra and Mira. Of course, this creates all kinds of other problems for the age of Abraham, which many people have been hung up on, as it would date these cities as much earlier than the traditional age of Abraham, 1800-1900, or some have put in faith in the 13th or 12th centuries. So in conclusion, the question of Baba Dra and the cities of the plains, I would say at the present that Baba Dra and Numera, keeping in mind the qualifications about the biblical text, are the only candidates we have. Doesn't mean I'm saying that Baba Dra is Sodom or Numera is Gomorrah, but that's the evidence as we have it at present. Thank you. I'll be happy if you're not all totally worn out to answer any questions. Yes, Thomas.
After four seasons of excavations, what is your reconstruction of the economy of both two cities in terms of botanical remains, farm remains, and possible trade connections?
I should really turn that over to David. Botanical. Why don't you want to take a stand at that as far as Mamera and Baba Dra, I think, is the more debate, and also up in the highlands. So you're the one that really has made those connections as far as botanical remains.
Okay, yeah, just briefly, because yeah, I did a dissertation on this, and I don't want to keep everybody here for another hour. At least the preliminary findings right now with the botanical remains, it shows that the botanical assemblages of both Baba Dra are very similar. Of course, Numera is only occupied during EB3, and Baba Dra runs right on through. And from that, you can say at least that their agricultural systems were either very similar at Baba Dra and Numera, or that they were exchanging goods so that the things were finding. That's the reason for the similarities. We've got good evidence from the size of some of the seeds, also from some geochemical analysis, spectrographic analysis of the botanical material itself, that they were using irrigation, probably crop rotation, rotating legumes and barley, wheat, things like that. The main crops we have are, barley seems to have been the most common, also wheat is represented quite frequently. Flax, we found quite a bit of flax, which hasn't been found at too many other EB sites in this area, or even in Palestine. Also, we've got good evidence that the flax was being, in fact, grown locally rather than imported, as it felt raw. A lot of different fruits, figs, olives, dates, and a number of wild species that grow wild, that are edible, and they seem, since they turn up so often, that they were
harvesting these wild plants?
Some of those would be imported from the highlands.
Right, yeah, we do have some things. All of this one that a lot of people say doesn't grow in the Gore, but in fact there are olives growing in the Gore now that do produce fruit. So it's difficult to say exactly whether the olives were grown locally or imported, but certain things, like we've got some possible wild plum that certainly would have come down in the highlands. We have peach, which we don't know about at this point. If, in fact, it is ancient, it would have had to have been brought in from a higher elevation. Also, almond has been found, not frequently, but that would have also been grown at higher elevations, too. So we do have certainly some trade connections between the highland and Baba Draw, and the fact that we found this large seeded flax, which has also been found at Arad. Amaran suggested that the flax found at Arad was probably imported from Egypt, since you don't find large seeded flax in Palestine or Jordan. But now that we've got it at Baba Draw, probably being grown locally, that's another indication that they were probably trading between Baba Draw and Arad. And also, I think you have certain limestone battle axes that comes in limestone. It's typical from the Hebron area. So there seems to have been trade both north, south, and east, west.
Much of the cloth that we have in the channel houses has been identified as linen.
And in terms of the fauna remains, what domestic species do you have, and is there any evidence of hunting making a contribution?
Lots of sheep, goat. There is some cow.
Some cow. I think pig also.
Some pig. But the hunting, the earlier phases that we haven't exposed that large of an area, so we can't really build up any evidence for any type of a transition between the hunting and agriculture community. But the EB1A evidence is dominant.
So it's primarily domestic species all the way through without any appreciable hunting evidence. Thank you.
Yes.
According to the pathological studies done by David, any of those vegetation or plants are mentioned in the story provided is found in it?
Well, I think probably quite a few of them, as far as the
regular crops.
The regular crops that are grown.
Unlike,
or you've got wheat, barley,
which
the olives.
I think it can grow wide as well. It isn't necessary to plant it. And it's very difficult from pathology point of view to identify the agriculture where they from the wild one.
Then I'll turn that over.
Yeah, that it can be at times difficult to tell wild barley from domesticated barley, especially if you have a very healthy stand of wild barley and compare that with a very unhealthy stand of domesticated barley, because there's an overlapping. On the other hand, it's natural that people select for the largest seeded plants, and so there are certain characteristics that I think it's too complicated to go into, what they call tough rachis. It's the type of stem that you find in the barley, which often turns up in the flotation, you can tell that has to be domesticated. Tough rachis barley won't survive in the wild. Also, the size of the grains, you have to watch that, because when it's carbonized, the size of the seeds changes. But there's certainly enough material that we've got. There are thousands of grains of barley and wheat to say definitely it was being domesticated. One other thing I should mention, too, from some of the geochemical spectrographic analysis, is that we find an increase of strontium and boron in both the wheat and the barley and the other plants, too. And I don't know if Tom's convinced of this yet, but it appears to me that from the EB1 period through the EB4 period, that one of the reasons you're getting this increase of these elements is that they are irrigating, and that over prolonged periods of irrigation, you do get soil salinity building up, which has been a problem with the East Gore Canal now, and I think will be a problem as they develop the area in the future. And you also find in the earlier part, EV1, roughly equal amounts of wheat and barley being grown, while EB4, there's very little wheat being grown, but a lot of barley being grown. Barley, again, is more salt tolerant, so I think we've got some evidence there that the irrigation was producing saline conditions in the soil.
Another question, sorry. It's from geological point of view, that evaporation of the salts from the Dead Sea, I think it's a very large percentage considered. So, did your geologist consider this according with the group of analysts to be studied, I mean, for some of your plants that could be planted or not?
He hasn't really entered into that. He's been really more concerned with the very local reconstructing, the local bedrock profile for us and trying to find cultural areas. I'm not aware,
or measure the percentage of evaporation of the salts from the Dead Sea nowadays. And I mean, consider it in the ancient times by years, and find out how much salt could be evaporated from the Dead Sea, on average, I mean, approximately, during this period, and if it is possible for such plants to grow in such salty weather.
We have taken some pollen samples, the deep cores down in the bottom, which is on the southern end of the Dead Sea. And have been able to reconstruct over a period. We're still trying to fix the dates more precisely on some testing of the Smithsonian. But we do have quite a good record of the type of plant pollen that was trapped in the Dead Sea. And it doesn't seem to have changed dramatically. It doesn't. It seems to have showed over 10,000 years. We have a core going back. We have a core going back some back to 10,000 BC.
Because of the salt. Is that right?
That's very interesting, cylinder seals. What were they used for? I think you know that we can have them tangles.
No, but we do have quite a few impressions on jars of cylinder seals rolled around the shoulder of the jar. In fact, up to this season, we have brought, say, about 24. This was the first time we came across the actual seal impressions. I mean, the seals themselves. But they seem to have been, the larger ones would have been used for rolling around the jar. The smaller ones would We haven't found, most of them we found are that larger size, the alabaster impressions on jars. Most of them are abstract. They fit, they're very typical of the seals published by Alain Ventour and his cylinder seals in the third millennium. Palestine, they're flat for the most part, flat cut. This small chlorite steel is very unusual in them, showing a series of figures. That's the first thing we found. Most of them are geometrical. Although we do have, and this again has got other examples published from Jericho, a marvelous one all the way around the shoulder of a jar, a big legendary jar of a lion chasing a gazelle, and the gazelle down on its back hind legs, with the lion just having got its hindquarters and so forth. Yes?
I'm worried about your machine in the sky that needed 12 people to hold it down. You seem to have an aeroplane.
Now that was a bipod built to spin to helm specifications.
That explains
everything. Going to spin as a technical advisor.
He claims that three people can do it. We usually have 12, and they felt their lives were in danger.
David killed the last one of the three guys who could do it.
Yes.
You're saying there's a lot of burn and ash layers and lots of of city walls and the location on these ridges. It sounds like these people were constantly defending themselves or being attacked. Have you reconstructed the political climate of the period?
The major destruction that we have is at Bumera. There's a really 50, sometimes 75 meters worth of ash and debris. But it only belongs to Bumera. It's only a one period site, so we can zero in on that further ones. It's the end of the early Bronze Age III when the site was destroyed. Whether it was an attack, whether it was an earthquake, which often causes fires, that's something we don't have the records to go along. Of course, some could look at Genesis 14, where they talk about the battle of the five kings against the four kings down there, and then make a case for that. The Ebla Empire could enter into it. I did forget to mention with Ebla that one of the reasons why several articles have been written about these sites is possibly Sodom and Gomorrah, is that in 1975, the first epigrapher of the Ebla expedition made a very sensational announcement in St. Louis when they were there that they had found in one of the Ebla tablets a list of the five cities of the plain, an exact order, Sodom, Gomorrah, Adama, Zeboim, and Zoar, that is Bela, and so forth. That turned out to be a little premature, as subsequent debates have shown, and many scholars, I think Robert Biggs of the Oriel Institute, whom I would trust, has very serious doubts about any of the readings as being reliable. Although Arkey, the recent the new epigrapher since the political problems of that the novel developed, has agreed that there are readings called Sidamu, Amor, Imara, and Zehar. But he locates them in a tablet which would seem to say that there are cities near Ebla itself, where Pentanado still argues that they refer to the biblical cities of the plains. But it's that historical record or contemporary document which has led many to say, aha, Ebla ends around 2400 BC, that early Bronze Age city where the archives are. These cities end around 2400 BC down here. There may be some connection. Friedman is one who argues, he got caught up in this debate, somewhat trapped, I think, with accepting Pettinato's early readings. But he still argues, if the texts do mention these cities, Sidamu, Imara, and Zaar, and they are not found in any other text from that point on, of all the cuneiform tablets we have in Mesopotamia, when argument is silence, he says, they must have been destroyed at that time. So, this is rather hypothetical.
Any evidence from your reconnaissances, especially you mentioned some sort of occupation or what happened after the evening war?
In our survey, and David has carried out a survey of the area for the Jordan Valley. Jeffrey King is down there this summer in that whole area. We have found nothing between the end of the early Bronze Age, and that's only about the probably the E4 period, and from Byzantine. There's Nabataean material. That's the earliest material. But that's quite striking. Well, I mean, I should say, except for three sites to the south, Safin, Faithful, and they all have iron tube. We did find, I should fix for that, we did find it actually published one tomb, south of Anazir, which has an MD jar in the Ravenland decoration. That's the one tomb. Yes? Well, that's a very interesting question. We find sort of a considerable amount of cultural continuity from the early settlement of the site. What we're interpreting those early shaft tombs are because they are basically secondary burials, is that it was a type of seasonal use of the cemetery area. There was no settlement on the site at the earliest period there. So they were probably coming down from the highlands. This is our reconstruction. Seasonally, and bringing their dead with them. They had them wrapped in baskets, which we find the traces of them, and burying these making secondary burials in these chamber tombs, which would probably have become a sacred burial ground for them by that time. Then we begin to see in similar type shaft tombs, although a little bit different, both pottery and the type of construction, articulated burials. And this coincides with the first settlement of the site, the first open village. So there seems to be just a gradual, and it really follows in the same cultural traditions, hardly. The difference in the burials is one, people coming in from the outside seasonally, and people being there on the site, starting the village occupation. But from that point on, there's a very strong continuity, except this is one problem we still have to come to terms with. The EB1B period, we find a considerable amount of destruction over the site, where we find the EB1B layers. In fact, one of the EB1B burial houses, which is a round burial house above ground, is completely destroyed, heavy burn layer. So something happens between at the end of EB1B and the what's taken up after that in the stronger expanding of the town EB2-3. There are two different theories on that, but both I and other sites in Palestine, they've
argue that this is a new wave of immigrants who impose this type of city settlement pattern upon the original indigenous inhabitants. That's one theory. The other theory, which we are leaning more towards, it's more of an indigenous development. This gradually develops, and what took place there at the present, we don't have really any explanation for it. I think so, because it's a similar type burial, and there is a nice transition in the EB1B period. They begin to build the round mud brick houses above ground, and then they start into it. We actually have one example of sides, long sides, but a rounded end, almost like an axe end. And then you move into the rectangular. But the type of burial and the type of sequence of the ceramic artifacts is quite continuous through each one of these phases. So it just seems to be a developing into a larger type of building without needing to hypothesize a new people. Well, there is certainly, yeah, there certainly is. There's strong signs of the growth in the population. Everybody's thirsty. Coffee or cake?
Perhaps I should say, too, there is a large cuneiform library at Baba Grah. Tom just hasn't been able to find it
yet. You're going to go down there this winter.
Thank you very much. I'd like to make a couple announcements. One is that Tom Parker will be giving a lecture here. When is that, Tom? Do you
remember? I don't think we've scheduled it. Yeah, early next month.
Okay, the 7th of December, and he'll be talking about his adventures in Syria and Turkey. And Lydia Hume has an announcement.
Excuse me, before everybody leaves, I have one quick announcement. As you all know, we usually have coffee and tea after the lectures. Today we have a special treat because ACOR is celebrating a monumental occasion at David McCreary's birthday.
There's an eagle coalition.